This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'm going to talk about central venous obstruction. It says stenosis in the program, but I'll broaden it out to be obstruction, new look at an old problem. So these are all different types of central venous obstruction: Paget's Schroeder syndrome, cellulitis in a swollen arm with a fistula, AV fistula, aneurysmal change over time with the central venous obstruction. But each one in some way is different. And there really has never been a universal set of reporting standards for thoracic central vein obstruction. This is why we really don't know too much about the prevalence, natural history, treatment, or outcomes. In fact, to summarize, I'd say that the literature on central venous obstruction stinks. Well, let's think about it in a different way. What if we didn't have a way to report peripheral arterial disease? We'd say, well, peripheral arterial disease is a complicated problem. Intervention gives mixed results, and we really don't know what to do. Well, that's what we say about thoracic central venous obstruction. Fortunately, in peripheral arterial disease, we have ways to categorize the patient's presentation, initially the Fontaine system, then Rutherford. We have anatomic classifications such as the TASC system. And at the end of the day, we have a great way to characterize patients who have peripheral arterial disease. But thoracic central venous obstruction, no reporting standards. And why? Well, we have met the enemy, and he is us. So that was something that I sort of complained about for several years. I'd give talks, and I'd say, well, the literature stinks. We don't know how to report this stuff. Just sort of waiting for somebody to come up and take the bait. And finally, somebody did, and that was me. So I decided to pull together a group of people and try to figure this out. But you recognize that it's not just a surgical problem or an interventional radiology problem. It's a problem that involves many different types of physicians and many different types of patients. And you can't move forward on this thing unless you include all of these people as you try to develop reporting standards. That was the birth of the central vein work group, which included interventional radiology, vascular surgery, transplant surgery, nephrology, hematology, oncology, cardiology, pediatrics, clinical anatomists, other people involved as well, not just physicians, but also nurses and other people who are involved in this space. We put together a group of about 20 people over the course of about 2 years, had at least 14 conference calls, zillions of emails, and we've sort of driven this thing forward to the point where I can share it with you. We've had members and officers from all different kinds of societies involved with this to try to put this together. This is not my sweet spot. This is not my strength. I am not a political guy. I am not great at this, and I found myself in the middle of this. It still is a hornet's nest, but it's moving forward, so I'll show you what we've done, okay? First off, the anatomy. So this is where we needed a clinical anatomist, actually a card-carrying, internationally recognized clinical anatomist, a guy named Art Daly, who helped us with some of the anatomy. So I'd ask you, where does the subclavian vein begin? Where does it start? And you get as many answers to that as you have people in the room. Everybody's got kind of a different concept of where this thing begins. But in fact, there's a pretty good clinical anatomy description of exactly where it starts. And it starts exactly at the lateral margin of the first rib where it passes into the chest. In fact, there are subclavian grooves that are on the first rib. So right where it passes over the first rib is where the subclavian vein starts. Not where the cephalic vein enters, not where there are other kinds of anatomic things. And in fact, the subclavian vein is just the continuation of the axillary vein. It doesn't really have a discrete venous change. It just is marked as by where it passes the lateral margin of the first rib. So that's where the subclavian vein starts in this dissected, this cadaver dissection. How about this? Is the internal jugular vein a central vein? Or thoracic central vein? Well, the answer is the central venous segment of the internal jugular vein starts at the superior margin of the first rib. So it's extremely short, okay? There's a short little segment that's intrathoracic for the internal jugular vein. Okay, well, that's anatomy, maybe not, you know, earth-shattering and not worthy of kind of an entire talk. We've come up with a series of diagrams, and these are in process, so I don't want to say that these are final, but these are the segments we're looking at, and I'll show you the obstructed segments in just a minute. So what's anatomically important features to describe for all thoracic central vein obstructions? Well, first off, how obstructed, and that's not news or rocket science. It's just stenosis up to 99% or a complete obstruction, 100%, which is an occlusion. But it is important to report, if you're going to report these patients, whether they have venous flow or arteriovenous flow. And finally, the type of obstruction. So based on that other map, and I'm not going to go through any of this, just to show you that these are the types of diagrams, we're coming up with a TASC type obstruction mapping, okay? So you can have a type 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, and then on and on. So you could categorize, and does this matter? We are not sure. But until we actually come up with a structure upon which future research can be done, we'll never know, okay? So this is trying to categorize the types of obstructions. Very simply, we need to report symptoms. And the symptoms are only fall into four categories, whether the patient complains of swelling, yes or no, pain, yes or no, onset of dyspnea, yes or no, which is probably more important for central or bilateral thoracic central vein obstruction, and also similarly for central nervous system symptoms. So these are the four symptoms. These are the three signs when you're looking at a patient reporting swelling. And certainly we have a methodology for recording the amount of swelling. This is one of the few quantitative measures that you'll have for a patient when you see them in a clinic with central vein obstruction. And you have to report unilateral versus bilateral or, you know, head and neck involvement. Skin changes such as discoloration, lymphatic blistering or weeping, stasis ulcers, infection, non-healing wounds or incisions. And finally, venous findings. Ectatic collaterals, venous thrombosis, and phlebitis. Now, here's something that we wrestled with for a while, which is duration of symptoms. And we scoured the literature. There's very little reported that brings all this together. And so we turned to the lower extremity venous obstruction literature and looked at what they had described. And again, there's very scant data on how to report this and whether it matters or not. Recognizing that for lower extremity, the accepted baskets of duration of symptoms, not of clot or not of stenosis, but of symptoms, are acute, subacute, and chronic, as you see here, should be reported in number of days. Days are continuous. If you report weeks or months, they can be discontinuous measures. And finally, a performance status due to the thoracic central vein obstruction, recognizing that some patients have a complete occlusion of a central vein, but they're asymptomatic. We often see this patients with previous catheters, internal jugular vein that's occluded all the way down to where it enters into the brachiocephalic. They're totally asymptomatic. Some patients are symptomatic, but it doesn't impair their daily activities at all. Some patients are symptomatic and impaired. Some are disabled, and some are incapacitated based on thoracic central vein obstruction. And finally, just to summarize what we recognize, that there were a couple of things missing, and those are functional limitations. So these are things that you might recognize that a patient has a problem with. They may not complain of it. It might not be a sign or a symptom, but they may have a problem with cannulation of an upper extremity hemodialysis access on the basis of arm swelling due to central venous obstruction, inability to place a venous access, which is a real big deal, and that affects pediatric interventionalists and surgeons in all different disciplines and so forth. If you can't place venous access, anesthesiologists, cardiologists, all sorts of people, if you can't get venous access. And finally, if there is thoracic central vein obstruction that somehow necessitates recanalization or intervention by any method. So these are all kind of things that you'd recognize are secondary problems. I'll summarize it. Thoracic central vein obstruction reporting highlights. One, to define the anatomy, that is stenosis or occlusion, and to report the flow, whether it's a venous or arteriovenous fistula type flow. And secondly, the anatomy of the obstruction with those obstruction maps we're working on. Second is to report within the four categories of symptoms, the three signs, report the duration, performance status, and functional limitations. Just go back to one of the cases I showed with Paget Schroeder, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just to say, this patient has an occlusion. They have a unilateral venous flow, type 1B based on this map. Symptoms are left arm swelling and pain, but no dyspnea or CNS symptoms. Signs are they have swelling, plethora. The measurements are seen here with a right arm of 102 millimeters, left arm of 128. Duration is 2 days, so this is acute. Performance status is that they're disabled with symptomatic presentation and disabled. And they have no functional limitations, none of those categories, such as there's been no attempt to recanalize or do anything at this point. Okay. Here's another case that I showed you, a patient with cellulitis and a swollen arm after they had a fistula placed. They've been on antibiotics for a while. They have an occlusion unilateral with AV access flow. It's a type 4 type of obstruction with the lower portion of the superior vena cava completely occluded. Right arm swelling, but no with pain. They have swelling, erythema, cellulitis, measurements, duration, performance status. I don't want to drag you through all the details. It's just an example to show you how this would be reported as we go forward based on the central vein work group recommendations for reporting standards. Where are these things at now? This has actually been endorsed by the Society of Interventional Radiology as a formal reporting standards project and is in process through the SIR. Good news for us is that the draft manuscript is nearly completed, and it will, we believe it will be co-published in the Journal of Vascular and Interventional Radiology and the Journal of Vascular Surgery. Tony Sadawe is the editor and has graciously asked us to please co-publish, and is the same editor, so we think there shouldn't be a problem there, but we're working on it. Many other groups are interested in endorsing the work, so we'd be looking for endorsements from other groups, and we've already had a number of organizations and societies approach us and say that they'd love to see these and see if they'd like to endorse them. We hope to publish this, before summer of 2016, probably be more like the fall, but once this gets into a more formalized SIR standards process, it'll go along for review by the work group and then others who are involved in the technology committee. And finally, there is other work that's being done on describing lesions, collaterals, etiologies. That doesn't exist in the reporting standards. It's going to be a necessary secondary part of all of this, especially the etiologies that cause these central vein obstructions. And finally, the nomenclature that comes out of this will be part of, hopefully, the electronic health record and global lexicon, likely adopted by insurers, and a really important foundational work for other applications. And with that, I'd like to wrap up my talk, and thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.